previously on Popping Collars.
You know, it's the anxiety over lack of knowledge. So what do? I'm going to make fun of
them. Oh.
You know, I'm just going to kind of, I'm unfamiliar. So I'm going to, you know, cast some stones and kind of, who really takes that seriously? Because I don't know enough about it, right?
Or like, so. I'm a priest and I read books.
Oh, God.
You don't read enough books. Why do you want to fall? You should be reading a book.
Right. It's
that attitude.
Yeah, I know.
I do exist online, I promise.
All right. Well, welcome to Popping Collars. This is actually a new mode of Popping Collars this time, because instead of a conversation between three or more people, we have two people gathered. But where two people are gathered, pop culture and religion still exist. And we are here to talk about it. This is Popping Collars, where you got pop culture in my religion, and I got religion in your pop culture. So, I am Greg Knight, back again for more of this madness that we call pop culture and religion, and the discussion of the intersection between the two. With me, back again, from the Presbyterian world, my stepbrother, Kyle Goodman. Welcome, Kyle.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back so soon, too. This is fantastic.
And welcome to a very experimental episode, a one-on-one conversation as opposed to a group conversation. I think we'll be able to carry it, though, as we talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And what a time to talk about it, because we have recently been graced with a trailer, an amazing trailer in a lot of respects, for the second Avengers movie, Age of Ultron. I'll go on record right now and say that I really miss numerals in movie titles. I think I know why franchises went away with the numerals in the sequels and went with the colons. But I'm not necessarily a colon fan, and so I sort of miss saying Avengers 2 instead of Avengers Age of Ultron. But
I think everyone knows what you're talking about.
Well, we
and,
got
you know,
the trailer.
You can't have a new number one issue every time if you put 2 in the title. It doesn't work.
Leave it to Marvel, though. They'll relaunch anything with a number one. Even a comic book that only has an issue one, I'm sure they'll relaunch with another number one. And then we, of course, also had Marvel announcing the slate of movies that they have coming up in their Phase 3, which takes them up to the year 2020. About 9 new movies coming out over the next 5 years or so. So I think where I want to start this discussion is in the year 2008, Iron Man hits movie screens. Not a whole lot of hoopla around the release of this movie. A little bit about the cast, because Robert Downey Jr. is just coming back from a hiatus in the acting world, or at least nothing big due to his past with sort of drug history, alcohol history, stuff like that. And so so this movie Iron Man is released in 2008. And if you were to stay through the just mind-numbingly long credit sequence at the end of that movie, you were treated to an Easter egg scene that featured Samuel L. Jackson in a role that was pretty much created for Samuel L. Jackson in the modern Marvel comic book continuity, where he announces something called the Avengers Initiative. And if anyone who knew comics at the time knew anything, it was, oh my God, they're going to get a team of superheroes together in one movie. That is such an incredible idea. And lo and behold, 6 years later, they've done it, and they've done it so successfully that they are able to basically say what movies they're able to announce 9 movies that they're set to release. That we have to assume, they assume, Marvel Studios assumes, is are just going to print money.
I love that that Saturday Night Live sketch recently. I don't know if you saw that. I don't know if anyone still watches Saturday Night Live anymore. But there was this sketch, and it was the follow-up to the Guardians of the Galaxy. And it was just any random character they could think of, including, you know, soccer moms from off the street, you know, Pam. Marvel's Pam. They're printing money at this point.
Did you ever think that you would see a day when Marvel comic book heroes were ruling the movie box office? Or any comic book heroes were ruling the movie box office? I think when I was, you know, a teenager collecting comics, late 80s, early 90s, this was such a world that it was such a niche geek culture.
Well, sure.
That there was no way that this would appeal to such a mass audience, in my mind.
Well, you know, there were the DC films, there were the earlier Superman movies, and then we had that, you know, glut of Batman movies in the 90s, some of which were okay and some of which were really horrible. But they were making money. But Marvel was always the one that didn't have their act together. You know, there was always the conversation in all the comic book magazines, oh, we can't ever get the rights to Spider-Man out of development, you know, there's this legal issue and that, and no one can ever get it straight enough to actually put on a Spider-Man film. And it was Spider-Man. That was the character that everyone was interested in seeing on the big screen. Forget, you know, B-list, C-list heroes like Captain America or Thor. I would have thought we would have seen a Thor movie, much less two, you know, or Iron Man.
Thor, basically Jack Kirby trying to create a God-man comic book, which was always Jack's MO, creating new gods and in DC and Thor and in Marvel. It's always trying to go for a comic book about God without just flat out calling it God, the comic book. But that actually gets us to something important, I think, which is, you know, clearly these movies have a stranglehold on audience members' imaginations. Is part of the attraction the opportunity for us to fully realize what used to only be able to exist in our imaginations? Are we in an age where miracles are actually possible to create, at least artistically?
Well, certainly, at least artistically, if not, you know, if not what we find for sale on Amazon today. I don't know. I think that, you know, asking that question, I think that, you know, the thing that appeals to me so much about these particular Marvel Universe characters is exactly that. You know, that larger than life, you know, world that things that we couldn't possibly imagine on screen, and yet, you know, it's the characters, you know, that we can still identify with. You know, we can find in that story, in those characters, those old characters, really, you know, a place to connect and a place to resonate. You know, we may not be able to imagine ourselves in the world with the Iron Man flying suit, but you know, but we can all identify with the attitudes and the swagger of Tony Stark. And, you know, that's our place, I think, with each one of these different characters, even with the God man like Thor, there's always a place that we can, you know, find ourselves and connect. And, they enable us to imagine not just that there could be these characters, but that we could be these characters. I mean, that was always the appeal of, you know, kind of back to Spider-Man. You know, he was, you know, Peter Parker, you know, just an ordinary guy that something extraordinary happened to. You know, Iron Man is just a guy who, you know, happened to invent this suit and becomes a superhero. Captain America was this scrawny kid that you know, could never have even been drafted until the super soldier serum and that, you know, program turned him into the super soldier.
I think that you're right about this being able to identify with the heroes and that being what made Marvel kind of stand out. You know, when I saw that first Iron Man movie in 2008, one of the things that my non-comic book friends said that they really liked about the movie was that they could identify with it. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, that they could buy into a man creating armor in a cave that could protect him and, you know, and then he could fly and do all these amazing things. But they did use phrases like, well, it felt real, or it felt like it was grounded, or it felt like it could really happen, or something like that. And I attribute a lot of that to the fact that that first Iron Man movie was all about the anxiety of terrorism and the other, and how this sort of faceless enemy was out there and could potentially kill us if we didn't protect ourselves. And that was, I think that was what people were identifying with, that meaning of who are they? Who are those people in the caves, and why are they trying to destroy me personally, right? I think that's the piece that I think resonated with people, and that's a very, you know, that starts from a very religious kind of place.
A place of fear and doubt and insecurity,
right? And in the sense of not wholly understanding the mentality or the ideology of the other that you have to share space with in this world. I think that first Iron Man movie was very much that.
And raising the questions about what, you know, what are we to be about in facing that other? You know, that's something that Tony Stark in that film wrestles with, and really through the arc of all three films, he wrestles with, you know, why am I building this suit? Is it to keep me alive, you know, with the shrapnel in my chest? Is it to advance technology? Is it to create a war machine, an Iron Patriot, a device that can be used to, you know, advance national security? Is it just my very fancy version of a hot rod sports car? I mean, that's played out quite a bit in what Tony Stark chooses to do with that Iron Man suit. And then finally, and it's there at the end of that first film, but it resonates again and again, you know, he's creating this technology to further the human beings, to further our ability to live, you know, faithfully and live in community in this world. You know, it's about clean, pure energy, oddly enough. I mean, and that seems like it comes almost out of nowhere in a film about a man in an iron suit. But, you know, what an interesting allegory for, you know, when we start shedding the trappings of greed and the trappings of you know, fear and insecurity and, you know, all those things that push us to go to war and to fight. You know, we find, you know, ourselves working towards something that furthers the common good.
Right. The armor, rather than becoming the mask, which, you know, the interesting thing about Tony Stark's arc over the course of those three movies is that at any given point, you could interpret what he's doing a number of different ways. It is self-serving at some point.
Sure.
And at other points, it's very much for the common good. And then at other points, it's for greed and for ambition, selfish ambition. And, you know, at other points, it's something else. All in all, the armor, even when he's constantly building it and constantly putting it on and trying out new models and new mocks of the armor suit, it feels like the armor is slowly paring away all of the things that Tony Stark has been putting on himself up to that point, so that by the end of Iron Man 3, we're shown who Tony Stark actually is, now that he's the man out of the armor. The armor, for lack of a better word, almost serves as a cocoon for Tony Stark to get from one phase of his life to another. It's funny because we see the armor as really as a mask, as armor, as a suit to protect him from things, and yet you could say that the suit makes him more vulnerable to his own attitudes and to his own beliefs.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, that, what a wonderful allegory for, you know, we may not have a metal suit of armor that's indestructible, but we
definitely have the armor of God.
Well, okay, wasn't quite going there. But, you know, we do project this outer shell, you know, that's I think designed to hide what's on the inside. And I do love that last scene of Iron Man 3 and you know, the idea of the cocoon, but, you know, not to borrow from the X-Men, but I always thought of it as sort of rising like the Phoenix, where everything's going up in flames, you know, at the end of that film, whether it be, you know, whether it be Pepper Potts, you know, who's about to explode, or the villain who does, or, you know, all these suits of armor just get burned. And you're right, what rises is an authentic human being. And I'm not sure that you could say that about him at any other point in any of the films. You know, sort of the, you know, the quest for being our authentic self. And we can all relate to that in a world where, you know, where things move at a pace that we can't keep track of or keep up with, in a world where, you know, it's increasingly difficult when we're bombarded with advertisement after advertisement and idea after idea to really know who we are. You know, that's an important message, at least at my church, that we, you know, always try to get back to the idea, you know, fundamentally, who are we? You know, we're children of God. And, you know, that's our identity in my faith community. And, you know, what ends up happening, I think, and what we talk about is how so many other identities and so many other burdens and weights are put on us that all of a sudden we just become these people, you know, carrying around this load and forget that, you know, we're at our most authentic. We're just, you know, creatures, you know, made by a loving creator. I'm not sure that we get that in Iron Man, but that's where
But it's interesting because you're this creature made by this loving creator, but you're not a finished product. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that I appreciate is that, you know, you're constantly working on this. You're constantly working on figuring out who you are and where God is calling you to be. And what God is calling you to be, you know, so this is actually a really good transition to where I kind of wanted to go, which is war. Vulnerability gets us to war. But honestly, there's one character from the Avengers that represents war, and that's Captain America. And Captain America is a great character because Captain America ties us back to an age of where comic books served a very real purpose. Captain America existed alongside Superman as morale boosters for World War II troops, to the point that it was actually to the point that Captain America was discontinued when the war ended, and Superman was very close to being discontinued after the war ended. These were the super soldiers. Superman not necessarily fighting for the Allies, because of course Superman would win. Couldn't have an editorial staff faced with the problem of figuring out why Superman wasn't on the front lines against the Germans or the Japanese. But Captain America very much could. Captain America was a soldier that could fight alongside the U.S. men and women. And yet, Captain America is a character that is still vital in 2014, a character that is solely created for World War II and for a world that's at war, is now reinterpreted for another world that's at war. And yet, a world that doesn't understand its enemy, that isn't able to point to a map and say there, there, and there—that's the axis of evil.
And
the Captain America that exists in the movies, I think, is a really interesting Captain America, because it's Captain America that wants to fight bad guys and yet has no idea who the bad guys are.
Well, and isn't it interesting that he's the one who always asks that question in, you know, a character, as you say, who's created basically to go out and fight the Nazis and to fight the Japanese. And, I mean, he's a prop character in that regard. But in the films, particularly the last film, you know, he's the only one who at every turn is questioning, you know, am I fighting the right bad guy? Who do I trust? You know, I am hardwired to serve my country, but what does that mean? I mean, those are all questions that we all have to ask in a post-Vietnam world, and certainly now in a post-Iraq war. You know, world, you know, did we make the choice to fight this war? You know, was it the right choice? Was it a just war? And, you know, Cap wrestles with that just the same way that we do. He may be a super soldier able to go out and, you know, take out 100 bad guys for every one that a normal soldier could, but he's left with the same dilemma. You know, what am I fighting for?
It's an interesting, there's an interesting dynamic that happens in the Episcopal Church. And I imagine that similar circumstances happen in the Presbyterian Church and in every church that exists, which is that where I work with kids, right, where I work with children and youth, there's this expectation that after our youth get confirmed, maybe we're going to retain some of them for our youth group. More than likely, half of them at least are just going to disappear. Maybe they'll come back when they have families. Maybe they'll come back when they have their own kids. Maybe they'll come back after college. But there's this expectation that they will leave, that they won't necessarily be a vital part of our community. And certainly, once they go to college, there's an expectation that they won't even be a part of any community, really. That's their time to sort of figure out who they are and what they believe and stuff like that. It's not a helpful model.
No.
But it's a model that kind of exists, and I think that a lot of the churches that I've worked in seem to sort of begrudgingly accept it as reality.
I love that narrative. It sounds like we're sending them on a vision quest of some kind.
And what we're really
doing is mostly just saying, we don't know what to do with you.
Right,
we'd like
exactly.
to talk about you being here, but psst, we're kind of glad you're not. Please come back when you're normal, if you ever are again.
What I've found is that in working in forums with adults who have recently come back to a church, or even adults who have come back to church, but they've only come, you know, to Easter and Christmas, you know, or something like that, and they're a little bit older now, and they're starting to contemplate mortality, and they want to kind of hedge their bets just in case there may be something behind all this religious gobbledygook. Their experience of religion and Christianity is a Sunday school experience of Christianity. They have no necessarily nuanced approach to religion. It's still the old, you got to do good, you got to tell the truth, you got to listen to your elders, you've got to say your prayers and take your vitamins. Mentality. It's a generation removed mentality. And where I'm going with this is that's Cap, right? Cap comes from a time that's generation removed, where his America is an America that doesn't exist anymore. The problem was that he was on ice for the entire time that changes were occurring, that growth was occurring, and he comes back into this world with that old mentality. And what he learns is that mentality can't serve him where he is in his life, let alone in the world that he's kind of come back into. And that's what I sort of see happening with our young people in church, is that they go to church, they learn these lessons of, you know, be good and go to heaven, be bad and go to hell, kind of simple stuff, because we don't necessarily know how to talk to kids in a nuanced way. And then they go on ice for however many years, and then they get thawed out again at some point, but they don't have the tools to understand whatever this new church world that they found themselves in is. It's a lost kind of feeling.
Sure.
And it's a struggling to keep up kind of feeling. And that's what I appreciate about the Cap that we see in the Avengers, definitely. And in the new movie, is that it's a Cap who mourns the loss of his what his life was, and yet feels like it's his duty to catch up to what the world is.
And I think that's a really interesting point, not just for that demographic, but, you know, again, in particularly in this last movie, The Winter Soldier, I mean, when everything seems totally out of whack, you know, keep going back to Cap, because Cap seems to be able to be the only one in a world that shouldn't make sense to him to carry a focus. And he does it by asking questions. You know, he does it by saying, I don't understand why this is the way it is. Don't you think it shouldn't be this way? And I think that's the very voice that we hear so profoundly from those, you know, young people, whenever it is they are thawed out and come back. You know, those are the people who I hear asking those questions of the church. Is this something we should be doing? You know, is this what we're really about? You know, I hear a lot of talk about this issue and this issue and this issue, but then I actually go read the Bible like you told me to, and I don't see those issues being prominently featured in the scripture. What I see, you know, Jesus talking about quite a bit is, you know, caring for the poor and tending them, you know, and sharing good news and building connections and community. And yet you want to talk about these issues that now just seem very political to me. I think that's just very true, that, you know, what a wonderful perspective that, you know, those thawed out, you know, generation removed folks can bring to our church communities, because they call us on our junk.
You know, it's a really interesting juxtaposition. And I guess this kind of gets us into the Age of Ultron trailer a little bit that was leaked two weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, time flies. Feels like it was last week.
Yeah, we're on to Star Wars now, The Force Awakens.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, the thing about the Age of Ultron trailer is that after it was leaked, of course, I watched it about 40 or 50 times. And since I've watched the trailer so often, I've had to go back and watch Pinocchio again because I keep getting that song stuck in my head about the puppets with the string. It makes me wonder, like, if you cut other Disney songs over the top of the trailer for the Avengers, if it would come out more powerful. If you had someone kind of morosely singing, "You ain't never had a friend like me." All explosions and things are going on. that would be interesting. I challenge YouTube to come up with the whole channel of those. The trailer clearly features a team on the brink, and it seems like a team that's on the brink really because of one unstoppable engine of destruction, which is the Incredible Hulk. You know, I think that the Hulk is probably the one character that most mainstream audiences can really identify with. I think there are a few reasons for that. One, because of that gorgeous, now that I've gone back and rewatched it on Netflix, Bill Bixby show from the 70s. What a lovely show. And I just recommend everyone just watch it if you can, because not only is Bill Bixby's performance really incredible in every episode of that show, but it's so poignant and haunting. And they're able to tell a story in an hour of a man who has no place in society. And it's so wonderful. But that was a really popular show, and a lot of people identify with the Hulk from that show.
Right.
But there's also something really appealing. It's the Godzilla factor. Yeah.
Sure.
It's the giant creature that destroyed Tokyo, and that's always fun to watch on big screens. But here in the trailer for Age of Ultron, it seems like this engine of destruction has kind of gone too far and is starting to create a wedge between pro superhero people and anti superhero people, because at the end of the day, if you take this as reality, these are vigilantes who are taking the law into their own hands and doing suspect things that the government should probably keep them in check on, especially if they're going to be using powers in populated areas. What I realized from the trailer is that I think a line is starting to get drawn between the two characters that we actually talked about, between an Iron Man who has gone through the process of understanding who he is, juxtaposed against this new world that he's kind of come into of superheroes, and Captain America, who at his core is always a superhero. He's never Steve Rogers. Steve Rogers died in the tube.
Even Wimpy Steve Rogers was a superhero, you know.
Right. It's at the core of his being. He can't be anything else. That's what he is. And yet he tries to figure out how he can be that in another world. But there's no sort of introspection. There's no sense of growth in this character. He's grown. He grew in the tube. And he's done. and that's who he is. It makes me think that you've got two characters now that are on a collision course because of two very different ideologies. One who has kind of looked into the abyss of his soul in Tony Stark and come out the other side a different person. and one who has fought the battles from the past and the battles from the future, and very much sees the world as a place that can only be saved by having people that are there to fight for it. And at the center of this, I think, in the trailer, you have the Hulk destroying a city, and you have Tony Stark saying, "This can't happen." Mm-hmm. And you have Captain America saying, "This is probably necessary in order for people to be saved." I think that ultimately puts them on a collision course. And I wonder, I see this ideology kind of play out a lot, of people saying, our institutions need to grow in order to survive. And other people saying, no, our institutions need to maintain their core values in order.
Now you're talking about the church again. I see what you're doing there. You're not fooling anybody on Pop and Collar.
It's a gorgeous argument, right? Because there's no real right or wrong.
No.
There's something in between these two things. But
well, then,
yet I think that these two sides are diametrically opposed to each other.
Sure. Well, and I think we're called to hold those two things in tension with one another. I mean, and that's the well, that's where I struggle quite a bit, you know, in today's political landscape is, I mean, you've just very accurately, you know, and pointedly described two opposing viewpoints, at least as they relate to, you know, the culture and outlook of the church. And, you know, we make a terrible mistake when we just hold on to our core values and, you know, don't progress forward. And we make the same terrible mistake when we, you know, put ourselves in position to, you know, surf the wave of cultural change and adaptation and forget who we are. And, yeah. You know, the much, much, much harder thing is to stay, well, you know, in the metaphor of the Avengers, to stay the team when it's easier just to break apart because our ideologies don't fit.
There was a writer for DC Comics named Denny O'Neil, who is wonderful, wrote Batman forever, also wrote those fabulous issues of Green Arrow, Green Lantern, where the two heroes were basically traveling around America trying to figure out what the soul of this country was. My ward Speedy is a junkie. That's, you know, very much the Denny O'Neil plot, very issue based. And he made a great comment in a recent interview about the explosion of comic books and in popular culture, especially movies, where he said, comic book superheroes, the superhero genre, these are our American post-industrial mythology. This is our American post-industrial mythology. And this is why I'm glad you're here, because I'm going to try to go down a mythology route. And this is an area that I know that you're well-schooled in. But I think that what mythology does is it holds up a mirror, not necessarily to who we are, but it holds up a mirror to our anxieties as a culture or as a society. So, for instance, when comic books were first created, our anxiety was war, because they were created in 1938 for the most part with Superman moving forward. Of course, after World War II, radiation, the atomic bomb, and you give rise to the Marvel Universe, which basically all these heroes created through radioactive means, the Hulk, Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, which gives way to the 70s, where you have changing cultural and societal issues, give rise to things like Power Man, Iron Fist, Heroes for Hire, this idea that heroes aren't necessarily heroes out of the goodness of their heart. Sometimes they need to get paid, which leads you to the 80s and, you know, Alan Moore and Frank Miller's sort of scathing critiques from two very different political ends of the spectrum of what the 80s looked like as far as greed and power were concerned. The 90s, obviously, are just the time of excess, which played out in the comic book world, where you had the death of Superman bag of comics that had black armbands inside and stuff like that, and people buying them on the shelves and putting them away, thinking that they were going to pay for their kids' college educations with,
With these, everything in comics in the 90s was big.
Big it was guns, just ridiculous.
Big arms.
Big everything.
Big everything.
Just excessive. And then post 9/11, everything has really been about terror since 9/11 in the comic book world. It makes me think that there is something to this, that these are our myths that we tell each other to expose what anxieties we're kind of working our way through in our modern day. What role does mythology serve a culture, would you say?
Well, I think you're right. You know, back to your original point about sort of mirroring our anxieties, and, you know, whether it's, you know, those primordial, you know, Greco-Roman gods of, you know, thunderstorms and raging seas and volcanoes and, you know, the woods, you know, things that, you know, that, you know, bring out the fear and anxiety. You know, those things are always represented by, you know, these sort of anthropomorphized, you know, beings that just represent, you know, the lack of control over the natural world. And I think that you know, relating the superhero to the modern mythological character makes a lot of sense, because just as you say, these characters are all, you know, just completely reflecting our fears, whether it's atomic bombs or, you know, terrorism or, you know, just our own inability to, you know, to create control or structure in our lives. You know, they're all characters that have abilities and powers that are beyond the normal human being. And it's because I think we're all searching right now, and have been for a long time, you know, for the ability to advance ourselves beyond where we are. You know, a lot of us feel stuck and feel trapped and powerless in a world that where things like, you know, 9/11 does happen, you know, where things like Hurricane Katrina or the tsunami, you know, happen. You know, we may be able to understand those better than, you know, people of, you know, three millennia ago, but it doesn't necessarily mean we have any better handle on stopping them from happening or, you know, dealing with them when they do happen. And, you know, those heroes, you know, those characters, you know, they often represent a particular value or trait that we can connect with or relate to, whether it's, you know, Steve Rogers being the, you know, the scrawny guy beat up by a bully who, you know, all of a sudden, you know, his courage is now reflected in, you know, the strength that he has, or, you know, whether it's, you know, Peter
becoming a green rage monster.
Right. I think we all carry around a big, giant, raging green monster inside us. And we, you know, how we give expression to that. I mean, what a great, you know, metaphor for the struggle of so many people. You know, what do we do with the anger? How many people do either of us know who really managed anger well? You know, not very many.
And how many people do you hurt when it does kind of bubble up to the surface? However it bubbles up to the surface.
Sure. And you know, back to the Hulk. I mean, and the interesting point that is, you know, one of the very modern fears and anxieties that I don't know that you find in those old Greco-Roman or Norse myths It's just the fear of the self, you know, the fear of what's really, you know, going on inside of us. You know, we have the fields of, you know, psychology and, you know, and anthropology and those things have been illuminating. But, you know, when we really stop and consider what's going on in our own inner life, you know, what a struggle that can be. It's one that, you know, that our faith has spoken quite a bit about. One that, you know, our faith has quite a lot to say about and help with. But I think the people who sit on our pews on Sunday morning are all, to some degree, and even those who are up in the pulpits like me, you know, wrestling with those inner demons, you know, wrestling with those inner struggles, whether it be anger or hurt or unresolved grief or just the struggle of trying to make ends meet. I mean, that's where our people are, and we wonder why, you know, they don't commit themselves to being more involved in 15 different programs of the church, or spend 4 nights a week at the church for this activity or that, or, you know, really seem to have gained a lot of insight from the Bible study they've been doing. You know, are we really meeting people with the, you know, where they are on those issues?
Don't you know we saved the world? And if not today, then maybe tomorrow. Don't you know we saved the world? And if not today, then maybe tomorrow. We saved the world. We saved the world. We saved the world. We saved the world.
Yesterday evening when I had some beer, a church came to me and said, listen to me, son. The only one can save us is you and your silly band now.
Okay, we got about 10 minutes left, so let's do confessions.
Fair enough.
Confession segment, since we're talking Marvel Cinematic Universe, really easy confession. What is your favorite Marvel Studios movie so far to this point? So we're talking Iron Man up through Guardians of the Galaxy. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to go with Guardians of the Galaxy, and I'm going to go there because we haven't talked about it at all. Although I really, really did like it. What I liked about it, other than it just being a Star Wars-esque space opera that I just thought was really entertaining and funny and thoroughly enjoyed Chris Pratt, who had a fantastic year this year. I like that it's a movie about finding community. I mean, it begins with the loss of family and, you know, ends with a group of misfit characters. You know, I think you could maybe make the argument that the Avengers are, in some sense, a group of misfit characters. But really, I mean, if that's true, they're still all the beautiful people, aren't they? And, you know, let's go out and find the 5 hottest people we can cast in the film, and here they are. You know, when Jeremy Renner is the ugly one These are the beautiful people, okay? But it's not so much true for Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, these characters are really misfits completely. You know, instead of Thor, we have Rocket Raccoon. Instead of, you know, the Hulk, we have a tree who's only able to say, you know, three words, "I am Groot." You know, the characters are, I mean, they're just, I think, B-list, C-list characters. If the Avengers used to be B and C-list characters, you know, the Guardians of the Galaxy are just F-list characters, and, you know, and that's that. And yet, the movie about them has made the most money this year so far. Right. But I think it's because the story is so good, and it is a story about, you know, oddly enough, finding yourself in community and in family, and, you know, joining together to be something bigger than you know what you are, you know, as separate individuals. And, you know, at its best, that's really been my faith experience, is coming together with a group of people who, I mean, maybe we're not all exactly misfits, but coming together with people from different walks of life who don't seem to have anything necessarily in common, or who wouldn't necessarily be there otherwise, and in the work of the Spirit to be made not just into a community that can stand each other, but to be a community where we're genuinely loved. I mean, like I said, at its best, that's been my faith experience, whether it was in our old high school youth group or in any of the youth groups I've worked with since, or on good days, the church as a whole, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the church has been that. And, you know, I think there's a lesson that the church can learn from a film like that and a story like that, you know, today. And it's something I find myself missing, you know, just that sense of unity and purpose despite our differences. And so I'm going with Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, certainly, even just the Pauline one body, many parts, mm-hmm. right? The idea that those parts don't just all look alike. One of them's a raccoon. And one is a green-skinned woman. You know, it's like it's a great example of God doesn't always meet your expectations. Mm. What that one body should be. So it's funny you picked the last Marvel film. I actually picked the first Marvel Studios film.
We Iron go for Man. Symmetry here on Popping Collars. It's all good.
That's neat. We look for balance. Yeah. We got to look for balance. Iron Man from 2008. And, you know, partially the reason I love it is because of the whole opening, 30 minutes of the film, where we're introduced to a pretty charming Tony Stark just right out of the blocks. I mean, sells weapons. Not necessarily the best line of work that you can possibly be in. And yet, at the same time, you know, goofing off with soldiers in the back of a Humvee, and, you know, I just found him to be totally disarming. And, you know, and that was something that I really appreciated about what Robert Downey Jr. brought to the role. This kind of self-assured quality, but behind the self-assuredness was this feeling of brokenness, I think. It sort of runs through the character, and it becomes literally broken, mm-hmm. when his heart, you know, has shrapnel inside of it. But he's already kind of a broken person through his relationships that he can't quite get right at any point in his life, be it his father, be it his sort of surrogate father, Obadiah Stane, be it his maybe girlfriend, maybe not girlfriend, Pepper Potts, just can't he can't get any of these things right because they're all fractured in his life. And he spends that first 30 minutes in that cave as a hostage of Ten Rings, the cult of the Ten Rings or something like that, trying to put himself back together again. Sort of like a Humpty Dumpty character. Mm-hmm. And yet it all comes together in the form of this Tin Man. This Tin Man with no heart, who sort of blasts himself out of this cave and reinvents himself into a vision of himself that he can stand to look at in the mirror. You know, and that doesn't mean that it's going to happen overnight. That's what I love about Tony. It's not that he escapes that cave, which is a very cathartic moment, a very powerful moment in his life, and he always looks back on that moment and thinks, well, this is when I was reborn. But it's not like that sort of prototypical kind of Christian born again moment, right? Where I came into the tent revival one person and I left this totally different person, and from now on that's how I'm going to live my life. No, he's still the Tony Stark, you know, that came into the cave. He's still that guy. He's just a different kind of that guy.
Sure.
Yeah, so everything about that first Iron Man movie, from the direction of Jon Favreau to just even the way that Iron Man is presented, you know, Spider-Man was really the only other superhero movie I can remember that took place during the daylight. Mm. And just seeing that Iron Man armor under the sun out in the open in the daylight, there was just something about it that was just totally compelling. And I was in, at least for the Iron Man stuff, moving forward, from that point on. And,
well, and it occurs to me that, you know, none of us go in the tent revival and walk out changed, not completely, not in a perfect finished way, you know, whether it's the tent revival or, you know, the unrememberable moment of our infant baptism, or it's, you know, the Sunday school lessons or whatever process, you know, we may be able to point to that moment where, you know, our life is different because of faith, but it's a mistake to think that it's done. You know,
I mean, that's true. Yeah. It's, you know, what a great character. What a great character for Robert Downey Jr. to play, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is a character who, in the comic books, develops a drinking problem, hits rock bottom at one point, and has to step away from even being Iron Man. You know, yeah, that tent revival piece, that's one way you can say it. Another way to say it is that rock bottom time. Right? A lot of people talk about in recovery, they can't make it through recovery unless they hit the bottom. And the thing about hitting the bottom is that doesn't mean that once you hit the bottom and you start putting your life back together, that person that was before, that came before, doesn't exist anymore. Right. That person is very much a part of who you are, to the point that you have to talk about that person for the rest of your life in meetings in order to understand who it is that you've become since that rock bottom moment. And for Robert Downey Jr., who had those personal issues in his life, to play a part of a character who has those personal issues in the character's life, I just think that it was just a good mix of an actor who understood the role, and a role that was probably well suited for the actor.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, the memorable line at the end of the film, "I am Iron Man," and I mean, it's true. What a perfect way to end the film, because it works on so many levels, and that certainly is one of them.
So it's time for our Go In Pieces segment. This is where we get to plug our social media, our websites, our what have you, ways for people to get in touch with us. So, Kyle, tell us who you are, where you're working, and how people can get in touch with you.
Sure. Well, again, I'm Kyle Goodman. I'm the pastor of Concord Presbyterian Church in Statesville, North Carolina. And you can find us on our website, concordpreschurch.com, or, of course, on Facebook, or you can find me on Facebook. I'd be glad to share with you in that particular version of social media. But as I mentioned in our last podcast, I'm not yet a part of the Twitterverse. Maybe I need to join it so I don't have to apologize for it in a podcast over and over again. We'll see. But that's that for now.
And I'm Greg Knight, the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida. You can find us online at bbts.org. You can find Popping Collars in all kinds of places. You can find us on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on the Facebook, Popping Collars. You can also email us poppingcollarspodcast@gmail.com, where you can friend us and we can write back to you in all kinds of ways. That's Popping Collars for this week. Thank you, Kyle, for being with us, and keep those collars popped. We'll see you next time.